Welcome to the Liberation Pedagogy Podcast. This is a place where radical ideas and methods are discussed in the quest towards freedom making. It is a space to dialogue, share, and learn about revolutionary politics, political struggles, radical solidarities, cultural resistance, healing justice, and is a crossing to unearth legacies of resistance pedagogies, global radicalism, and internationalism. I'm your host, Chani Desai, and if you like this episode, please subscribe. Hi, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Liberation Pedagogy Podcast. In our series on uprisings and pedagogies of rebellion, our guest today is Beverly Bain. Professor Beverly Bain is a Black queer feminist, anti-racist, anti-capitalist scholar. She teaches women and gender studies in the Department of Historical Studies at the University of Toronto, Mississauga campus. She currently teaches and researches in the areas of Caribbean and Black diasporic sexualities, Black and Caribbean queer feminist organizing, sexual assault and violence against women. Bain has devoted 40 years of her life to feminist anti-racism and anti-capitalist organizing and activism in the city of Toronto. She was the executive director of the National Action Committee on the Status of Women, Canada's largest feminist organization from 1992 to 1997. As an educator, she views the work in the classroom as connected to the larger community locally and transnationally. Bain is also the author of the articles Fire, Passion, and Politics, The Creation of Blackorama as Black Queer Diasporic Space in the Toronto Pride Festivities, as well as Uncovering Conceptual Practices, Bringing into Lived Consciousness Feminist Activities on the Toronto Police Services Board Audit. Bain is currently working on a series of essays on Black radical feminist queer organizing in Toronto from the 80s to the present. So Beverly, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Chani, for having me.
So, Beverly, before getting into our first question, I just want to situate the contemporary moment that we're in. Just a few weeks ago, we saw the public lynching of George Floyd and the police killings of Breonna Taylor, Tony McDade, and others in the U.S., which led to mass rebellions. And those rebellions have reverberated to Canada, especially after Regis Korchinski-Paquette, an Afro-Indigenous woman in Toronto, was killed during a police intervention in her Toronto apartment. And then we also saw that followed a few weeks later with, the death of Ejaz Chaudhry when police intervened during a call for mental health support. We know that state violence, particularly police violence and systemic racism, is no exception in Canada. And this whole country is founded on those logics. And so I was just wondering if you can begin today by speaking to the historical antecedents of state violence and systemic racism in Canada that precedes this contemporary moment, and particularly the historical antecedents of Black struggle in the city.
Let me start by saying I came to Canada in the mid-70s. Mm. I think it's critical to always track when you enter in, when you leave a particular diasporic space, which you knew as home, which is in the Caribbean, and you move to the, to the North American diasporic space, which is that of Canada. And what that means in terms of that process. I came here in the mid-70s to go to university. It was also a critical time in the Caribbean. Mm. It was just right after the Black Power Uprising, which was in 1972, which started in 1969. Basically, and moved, kept surging at different points till 1972, in 1972, a number of university students from the University of the West Indies took to the hills as a way to, capture the country away from the current, what they saw as the post-independence leadership that wasn't in any way transforming society, right? Mm. So that the majority Black population and also Indo-Caribbean population, at, you know, both of the largest and most disenfranchised at the time, were actually not in any way becoming, things were not shifting and changing in terms of socioeconomic and political and education, right? And it was this where they actually felt that they needed to make a statement or to in some way try to intervene by grabbing power and taking control. And that was in 1972. The government deployed its a regiment and military with help from Britain and the US. Eventually, the police and the assassinated, or I would say, executed these individuals, 5 to 7 of them on the hills, claiming that they. And they entered a shootout with them, but they were all pretty much shot in their backs. Mm. So that should tell us something. During that period, we also know that there were things happening out here. It was happening in other parts of the Caribbean, like Jamaica, but it was happening in North America. Here in North America, in 1969, 1970, was the George Williams University protest. Right at the end of the 1960, when students took over George Williams University and did a sit-in and a lockdown because of the racism at the university, right? Mm-hmm. And they took over the computer station, demanding that the professor, a white professor, who continued to fail students in the sciences, black students from the Caribbean in the sciences, even though they were actually some of the most, some of the most talented students in his class and were doing really well. He was still failing them so that they could not go any further. You know, they took possession and they shut down the university. And what they did was they called in the police and, Sûreté Québec. And, there was a lot of brutality against the black students. Black female students were beaten. They were sexually assaulted by police during that time. These students were arrested, a number of them from the Caribbean, and deported. Mm. So we know that there's that history. And I guess I'm saying that history because while all of that was happening there, we were aware that this was happening here as well. Mm. And that there were protests, you know, happening in the US as well. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there was an upheaval, a movement, a global movement happening. And what then was not called global, but international, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. An international uprising of black oppressed people, in the West, in the Caribbean, in South Africa, yeah. Against apartheid in South Africa, against racism in the U.S., the Jim Crow system in the U.S., against racism here in Canada, right? That treated black people in this country as not belonging, as suspects, as in terms of being criminalized. As not belonging in this country. In fact, one of the things about Canada that has been different to the US is that Canada has always pretended that blackness did not belong in this environment, that blackness was somewhere else, that being in the US primarily, that's where blackness really originates and belong, or blackness in other parts of the world. But Canada has always pretended that blackness never resided in this country, even though slavery existed in Canada in the 1600s. Black people were here since the 1600s. Mm. And therefore, the two founding, systemic and institutional and structural systems that shape this nation is that of slavery and settler colonialism. Mm-hmm. And to not actually speak to both of them simultaneously, knowing that, the edges differ in terms of how that violence plays out and how it impacts us differently, but to understand that these two structures were that which shaped the building of this nation.
Absolutely.
In
Absolutely.
A profound way. So when I came to this country, I came within that context of all of this happening, all of this previously happening in the Caribbean, in Trinidad, from where I come from, and in Canada, in Montreal, but also what was still happening elsewhere, well, that there were continuous, struggles of Black people here in Canada fighting, and struggling against racist oppression. I mean, you know, I would read stories while in Trinidad, get newspapers like from, the West Indian Gazette from Britain that that was authored by Claudia Jones from Trinidad, who moved to the U.S., was deported from the U.S. for her political activities to Britain, right? And continued to do that work in Britain, right? So we see that we continued to, we see that international movement of struggle continued to play out. And many from the Caribbean, and I want to specifically speak about many from the Caribbean, were actually really instrumental, particularly Black women. And I want to name that because, you know, we keep talking about the struggle as if the struggle was led only by Black men and fronted by Black men, but it's women who were working and shifting the ground, taking risk, such as Claudia Jones and many others who left the Caribbean and went to North America and to Britain, and became really instrumental in the struggles and movements abroad against imperialism, against against neocolonialism, against racism, against gendered racism that was happening. And when I came to this country in the mid 70s, the first thing I remember saying to my mom was here already, and I came to go to university. I finished high school and I came to go to university. I was accepted at the University of Toronto in the mid 70s. And I came and the first thing I said to my mother, I said, "Mom, where do you find Black people in this city?" And she said, "Go to Bathurst and Bloor." And I went to Bathurst and Bloor. And I got out of the subway. And right at the subway, they were giving flyers for a Black man, Albert Johnson, who was murdered by the police. They were giving out flyers. And I grabbed one. And I said, "I'm looking." I was told about the Third World Bookstore. And I'm looking to find the Third World Bookstore because I hear this is the place where Black people get together every weekend and have conversations about politics. And they said, "Oh, just walk north on Bathurst and to your left at the first corner, you're going to see Third World Bookstore. You can't miss it." It's a big sign. And in the meantime, hold on to this. And then I recognized that the people that I had just met were handing me out, included Sharona Hall, who has passed, some members, other Black activists. I remember Makeda Silvera, who was the only Black woman to establish a press called Sister Vision Press, the only press that was ever established in this country, established here in Toronto, for writers of color to be able to publish their works. Because one of the things that became clear is that there was no space for Black, brown, racialized, indigenous, queer writers to have a space to articulate their voice, their work. And she and her partner created a Sister Vision Press, which allowed and produced a series of writings, and poetry by Black, Indigenous, racialized, and queer writers in this city. And it was her. And then I also met Dion Brand for the first time. Wow. Didn't know who these people were, but they were my first entrance into this city in its political, in a political way. By grabbing this, then I headed off to Turnbull Bookstore, and that began sort of my involvement, because I immediately went to the protest and I immediately started to push myself in there and find ways to, you know, participate in the struggle. And I have never stopped since.
Absolutely.
Okay. So that gives you a sense. And Third World Bookstore, it was very instrumental, because one of the things of the movement, and I am not so sure that that is as clear in this struggle as it was then, is there was a political education component to the struggle. We just didn't get on the street. We had meetings, we had conversations, we had discussions, we came up with political positions, but that didn't just come up by one or two people. It came up through political education, not just, you know what I mean? So we would go to Turnbull Bookstore, we would have conversations, we would curse each other, particularly the women cursing men because of their, you know, their sexism.
Of course.
Right? Yeah. And, and we would engage and we would talk about everything, Marx, Che Guevara, the communism, socialism, you know, Zimbabwe, Mozambique, Angola, Cuba, everything.
So there was a deep internationalist tradition here.
There was a deep internationalist tradition that does not exist in the same way. Yes, we have a global struggle, but there was a connection. People traveled to each other's spaces.
Right.
People did work with each other across, you know, an amount and within the diaspora, right? You know, I mean, when the first meeting here in Montreal, right, of the writers, the black writers, they brought Stokely Carmichael here, right? So there were, people from international political leaders traveled back and forth and made, you know, and made appearances and speeches, you know, at particular forums that were happening here in Canada, you know, during the 60s and 70s and 80s, right? Right? So, you know, as time went on, the Black Action Defense Committee was formed around the shooting of black men in this city.
Okay.
Right? In the early 80s, that came into existence. People like Akua Benjamin and Sharona Hall were the two key black women in the Black Action Defense Committee, and who literally were the leaders. I mean, we know that the men, you know, were the face of the movement and also played and were the leadership in the movement. But the thing about black politics during that period was that blackness was always associated with black men. Black women were seen as the ones who were behind the scenes, you know, who were the ones who, you know, organized the food and the other events.
The reproductive labor.
All of the reproductive labor. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. But what was really happening was that the women were the ones on the front line. The women were the ones risking their lives. The women were the ones who were standing between police and everybody else, like Sharona Hall, for instance. Fearless as hell. So what we saw happening during that time is that the women were constantly at the front of the struggle, but not seen at the front of that struggle. So for a number of us who were black radical feminists, some of us who were also queer, or at that time we identified as lesbians, you know, we also recognized that sexism was a major factor for us, as well as sexuality. And that was always actually being undermined in the struggle, right? That we always kind, we are always challenged to make choices about, you know, well, if you, you know, you need to put that aside because really what's critical here is the race, the, you know, the struggle around race. And as if, you know, the struggle isn't intersectional, right?
Right.
So that was always a struggle for us. So many of us also decided that we also wanted to organize within, you know, feminist circles. I joined the Communist Party when I was at the university. So I became a member of the Communist Party. And I worked, and a lot of my work in the Communist Party was focused on international work. So I did a lot of work with the anti-apartheid movement in South Africa. I worked with a lot of people in Zimbabwe, Angola, in Cuba, right? And I did a lot of work here in Toronto around anti-racism, imperialism, you know. But then I also struggled with the Communist Party that didn't, that did not understand race as not just, you know, reduced to class, right? But that race was also, you know, socio-political and cultural and had to be addressed within, you know, the context of the work that we are doing.
Completely.
And that was very difficult. The party was not accepting of that because, you know, the Communist Party, like all others at the time, was very reductionist to a class-based politic. And what I also recognized was that, you know, there was no, you know, there was no room for a real fundamental analysis of sexism. And then, of course, sexuality. So I struggled with them during that period, right, until I eventually left in the 90s. I was in the party for, you know, about 15 years and also on the Central Committee. And the only, there were two of us who were Black on the Central Committee, actually. And I did live in different parts of the world. I lived in Moscow. I lived in, you know, Cuba, you know, and other parts of the world during that time, doing work and studies. And then I, you know, in the meantime here in Toronto, you know, I became very much involved in, you know, working with Black activist feminists. You know, I was not part of the Black Women's Collective, but I did work with them, you know, and they were, you know, the collective that was formed of Black women and Black queer women to actually take on and to mobilize and to organize, you know, against the state, racist, you know, colonial and colonialist capitalist agenda, right? And to organize and advocate, you know, for Black women here in Canada.
So can you give us an example of what, like an example of what that organizing against police violence and systemic racism look like? Just a couple of, you know.
Well, when Sophia Cook was shot in 1989 by police. Sophia Cook was a Black woman who was traveling in a car with some other Black men. She was offered a ride, and they she took the ride, and she was sitting in the car, strapped, you know, in, you know, to the front with a seatbelt, and apparently the cops marked this car for some reason, and and there was either, you know, they were on the hunt for it, or the people in the car, whatever the rationale was, they stopped that car and they approached that car with their weapons out, and he fired into the car, and Sophia, the other men were in the car, ran and got out and ran, and Sophia Cook was shot while sitting strapped in that car. And a number, a huge organizing took place. The Black Action Defense Committee, women, the Black Women's Collective, and a number of us women who were also racialized women who were non-Black, got together with the Black Action Defense Committee, and we wrote up a statement, because one of the things that we were concerned about is that we started at that point to recognize that Black women were also brutalized by police too.
Of course, right.
Black women were also being abused. Black women were being shot by police. Mm-hmm. Black women were beaten by police. And that the nature of that violence that Black women experience at the hands of police is very gendered and sexualized. It usually takes place in the home, mm-hmm. as we see with Paquette, mm-hmm. with Regis Korczynski Paquette. It takes place on the streets, in out of the visibility of, you know, of everybody else. It's usually Black women who seem to fit a particular description. You know, that tend to be Black women who are, you know, who are seen at, you know, in particular spaces, mm-hmm. that tend to be targeted by police, mm-hmm. and violate by police. And in general, Black women pose a particular kind of, you know, gendered and sexualized danger to police. And I say danger in inverted commas, because it's more a perception, mm-hmm. of them as a danger, but a danger, but the kind that need to be subverted and put in its place. Mm. Okay, so we see that, and we recognize that, and we also recognize that Sophia Cook was taken up as another example of police killing of Black people, and we also knew that this was different in the sense this was a Black woman, and this was a Black woman who was shot by police, and there's a gendered aspect to talking about Black women's lives, and it is a way to bring to the forefront that Black women get beaten and shot by police too. Thus that particular that organizing took place. Then we morphed into Women Against Racist Policing, a number of us. It consists of Black and racialized women. And we actually organized around, all forms of, police brutality against women. We actually supported women who called the police in cases of domestic violence, where they themselves were actually charged or beaten by police. Right. We've had several cases where women of color were beaten by the cops after they called police, right? Because they have of how they responded to the police.
Right.
So we have seen this sort of, so those were some of the kinds of work that we started doing with Women Against Racist Policing. So that period of the 80s, the late 80s to the mid 90s, was a period when all of that work was going on. All of that kind of organizing was happening. We also supported, the strip search of Audrey Smith, the Black woman who was stripped downtown by police officers, strip search in plain sight, because she was at a corner and they believed that she was a drug mule. And as a Black woman, she can only be a drug mule or a whore, right? And they strip searched her in public and said that she took her clothes off for them, which again emphasized that Black women use their sexuality as a weapon, right?
The trope, all the tropes.
Of the tropes. Use it as a weapon to scare and to frighten people. Because, of course, our sexuality is so scary that we use it as a weapon to scare you off, right? That was a period when all of this was taking place,
right?
And so that period was critical in the context of international political organizing that was anti-capitalist, anti-racist, anti-imperialist, anti-colonialist. It was also that which also was coalition cross. It was coalition based. It was also politics that ensured that we worked across race, class, gender, sexuality. You know, it took on, you know, the women's movement here. That is, and that in particular is the Black Women's Collective challenged the organizing of International Day by, you know, which was primarily led by white feminists,
right,
to change the script, right? You know, organizing from, you know, Toronto to South Africa,
right?
Prioritizing the lives of Indigenous women as leading, you know, the Women's March, followed by Black women. So, I mean, we had all of that already in terms of that particular kind of organizing and politics and understanding of how slavery and settler colonialism shaped this country. We were already operating and organizing within that vein.
Before transitioning to my next question, I just want to say thank you so much for sharing this radical feminist and internationalist history of Black struggle and organizing in Toronto and Canada. You know, it's such an important history that has prefigured this contemporary moment, which I think is so important for our listeners to really grasp as many of our listeners think about defunding the police or abolition and also how that might relate to organizing, but also how that might relate to the kinds of teaching they're doing. So thank you for that. And so moving to the next question.
How in this particular moment now, as we, you know, in the last several years, we've seen a sort of active resurgence of organizing around, you know, state violence. It's been ongoing and people have been organizing, but some of the visible kinds of organizing that we see today, what would you highlight as some of the differences between the past and the present, or what do you think has been lost over time?
Let me start by saying, I think this is amazing what I'm seeing in terms of the young people across, you know, racial boundaries, you know, Black, racialized, Indigenous, you know, here in Canada, you know, white allies. And we're seeing that in the States as well.
Exactly.
Yeah. Right? That they are taking to the streets. They are demanding that, you know, that Black lives matter, that they're demanding that police be defunded, be disarmed, that policing be abolished, that they're demanding that there be a, that we start thinking differently about a new way to understand, you know, a community safety.
Right.
Like we have to reimagine community safety that particularly focuses on saving the lives of Black and Indigenous people and people who are most marginalized in this global hemisphere,
right,
which happen to be Black, racialized, Indigenous, you know, and poor, and people who are homeless, who are, you know, the most marginalized, but also in terms of, you know, so it's about re-envisioning a different kind of understanding of what it is to have community safety and what it is to have, you know, what it is to keep people safe and to have livability and futurity. Mm-hmm. And what they are saying and what they have recognized is that policing is not going to give us that.
Right, exactly.
Is that the carceral state is not going to give us that.
No,
and that it's about time, it's time to end the carceral state, and it's time to end, you know, policing as it exists.
Completely.
Right?
So okay? So in many ways.
That's a really significant thing about this movement. Mm. And I think it's being able to be articulated more and much more clearer, because we have had a history in which to see how this has not worked.
Right.
Okay. right? We've had a long history that shows this shit did not, it has not worked for us. We've been reforming police for decades.
Right.
We have all kinds of commissions, all kinds of reports, all kinds of documents, all kinds of independent investigative bodies, all kinds of commissions. Indigenous people have multiple commissions. The RCMP is built upon the lives of Indigenous people's information, documentation, and their lived realities. Mm, mm, so mm. What more do we need to show that this is not working?
Right.
And it's only actually escalating because we have moved to a far more dangerous political time where we are living within an environment of hyper surveillance because of technology.
Right.
Hyper surveillance, new expensive technological devices that can capture people. We've always had ways to capture people, right? As a communist, as an activist, you've always been watched. But this is even far more sophisticated and far more dangerous with far longer reaches that are connected internationally and in ways that actually, is detrimental to the lives, as we have seen post 9/11 and the continued extrajudicial imprisonment and detaining of Muslims, right?
Absolutely.
So I mean, so we have seen how all this plays, how this is all connected. So there is no way that we can continue to say that all of what is happening here is actually is going to benefit us, or that we can reform it.
Right. So speaking of this, there are different, sort of groups of people that in which their paradigms around defunding or abolition,
absolutely.
At times their paradigms coalesce, at times they completely, move away. At times they're very Obama-ish, if you've seen,
what it's really said. It's really about reform.
Right.
Some people, the funding is about reform.
Reform, right? So
it's not about structural change. And I think the difference between the movement then and now is that in our times we were clearer about what our political positions were.
Right.
I mean, if we were fucking anti-capitalists, we were fucking anti-capitalists.
Right.
We were left wing, we were communists, we would say we were communists.
Exactly.
If we were Marxists, we would say we were Marxists. Mm. Right? There was no waffling there. And I'm not saying this is waffling, but there's more fluidity.
Right. Right.
Right. There's more fluidity and there's more coalescing of people of different political positions around what may be the same kind of slogan.
Right.
Right. There's more opportunities for co-opting of struggles now than there was then.
So to ensure that that doesn't happen, when you think about defunding police and you think about that in relation to abolition, in the city of Toronto and in Canada, what could that look like? Because, there are going to be a lot of people that try to co-opt these agendas through liberal reformist agendas. And I'm just wanting to hear about sort of a radical approach of how this can be done.
What we mean, what we are saying, and I'm saying, when I say we, I'm speaking about those who are Black radical activists and feminists and, and Black radical activists and feminists, BIPOC and queer trans people are saying, together with the No Police and also the No Police and Pride Coalition, we are saying that the funding means taking huge chunks, 50% of the budget, for instance, of the Toronto Police Services away from them, right? And handing that to communities so that they can decide how they want to use that to create sustainable communities, right? That does not require, an entrenchment in a law and order agenda, but becomes a way of reimagining how that community can create issues around safety for themselves.
Right.
And safety, and what that would mean in terms of creating safety for themselves. Right? Is also in terms of, pushing you know, the city and the province also to focus on refunding those communities, because a lot of the money that goes to the Toronto Police Services have been money that has been taken from communities, right? Those communities have been defunded so that the police can be funded,
right?
For their technology, for the law and order agenda, for other ways of policing the community, whether that be, you know, particularly in the in terms of, you know, policing properties and private property. Mm-hmm. I mean, the fact that private property becomes more important than lives, right? And that people can be ticketed for sitting in a public park at a particular time because they are seen as loitering. Mm-hmm. And it's a goddamn fucking public park and taxpayers pay for that damn thing.
Right.
We should be able to sit there until whenever we want to. Mm-hmm. Right? Homeless people to be moved away from these places. We are paying for that. It's called public for a fucking reason.
Right. You know? And to see policing as the protection of property is...
And to see policing as the protection of property, but also protection of property in relation to people.
Life, yeah.
So that our lives don't matter in the context of the protection of property. And if we should be seen as endangering property, we become dispensable.
Of course.
And particularly Black and racialized and Indigenous people are the ones who face that on an everyday basis in this country. And so that the idea of abolition is a process. Mm-hmm. When we think of defunding, that's only a part of the process. It's like the beginning of the process. What we really are moving towards is a complete abolition, where that we remove all of the funds eventually that will go back to the community. But that also requires an infrastructure to take place, to be recreated, meaning that more money has to go into social services, to social economic services, you know, to healthcare, to education, to community services, to mental and physical health, etc.
Right,
so that these communities can become sustainable. So it's a process. So it's not just, you know, looking at the police budget. Absolutely. It's also looking at the city budget.
Exactly.
It's looking at the provincial budget. Where is that money going? And what are we prioritizing? And why are we continually taking away money, you know, from communities that are most disenfranchised?
Completely.
And why are we beefing up a law and order agenda so that we can, police and violate the rights and life and livability of those people, because we believe that, you know, the protection of private property capital, you know, and the neoliberal agenda is far more fundamental than the protection of the lives of people.
I find often that sometimes race and racism gets, you know, disarticulated from class and gender and capitalist social relations.
Yeah.
I'm wondering, can you explain how the current rebellions in the US and the protests here in Canada are also part of a broader anti-capitalist struggle and gender justice struggles?
Okay. Well, I mean, let's be clear. If we're talking about, you know, defunding the police, which is what we're talking about, we're talking about demilitarizing, we're talking about disarming, we also simultaneously have to challenge the state in terms of, you know, the fact that this is a capitalist state that is invested, right, in corporatization. It's invested in private property. It's invested in supporting, you know, and continuing to foster, you know, support for banks and privatization. So the more that capital, the more there is an investment in capital and privatization, is the more that there is a reliance on a militarized state.
Completely.
Because people are going to
I mean, certain people are going to be the ones who are going to bear the brunt of this, mm-hmm. right? The state is divesting from social programs. The state is divesting from affordable housing. The state is divesting from all kind of education and recreation programs that are affecting primarily, you know, racialized Blacks, Indigenous, poor people, homeless people, right? The state is targeting, you know, non-status people, migrants, immigrants, and these are the people who are holding up this country. Right? You know, I mean, racial capital, this state, this country will not survive without a racialized body of workers who are actually at the margins, who are the most precarious, right? So when we're talking about all of this, we're talking about getting rid of the police, it's a simultaneous process of also challenging, you know, capital and working towards challenging the capitalist state at all levels, right? By calling, by demanding affordable housing, you know, by occupying spaces where, you know, there's so much empty buildings and empty places that can be made into affordable housing that when poor people occupy those spaces that are not used, the police, they're seen as loitering and they're harassed and arrested and beaten and brutalized by the police. But these are empty spaces that not being made use of. And these should be spaces that should be made into affordable housing. These are the spaces that we need to occupy and take over,
Yeah, I mean, and as you know, I think the pandemic in particular has really revealed, you know, which workers and whose lives are most disposable and exploitable and killable. You know, and so, yeah, but also as we're moving, as this helps me segue to move to the pedagogical question, Beverly, because it makes me ask you what kind of pedagogical approaches you use to teach about state violence in and outside the classroom. And I mean pedagogical approaches, for example, you know, anti-carceral pedagogies, anti-capitalist pedagogies, anti-imperialist pedagogies or feminist pedagogies. So what are some approaches that you might use either in the classroom or in your organizing work that can be used towards working against state violence?
In terms of the courses that I teach and the way that I teach my students, that we always have to have, that we always, my classes are always, they always carry a component where students can become involved somehow in some sort of activity, action, right? So for instance, I teach a course on post-colonialism and it's called Colonialism and Post-Colonialism. And I try to have students engage in political work. So because at the end of it, they get to write on a particular issue relevant to a particular area. So if we're doing the earlier period of colonialism, I'd have people write on Palestine. You know, they might choose Palestine, they might choose the Angolan Revolution. And I try to have students think about what it is that's happening and what has happened and where are we now in this world. And how do we make connections to what happened then to what happened now? What are some of the movements, the anti-colonial, you know, anti-capitalist, anti-racism movements that we can connect to and we can write about and we can also attend particular kinds of protests? So usually I go to protests and I take students with me to protest, right? I also teach a course on reimagining the archives and looking at the way in which we re-envision how we actually, you know, create archival information on various areas. And they do pieces on Palestine, they do on indigeneity, they do on, you know, anti-Blackness, they do on, you know, and they actually engage art, but they also engage activism. So my pedagogical, I would say that my pedagogy is a combination, you know, of theory and praxis and activism, right? I refer to myself as a scholar activist. So I never teach theory without it being actualized in some way, mm-hmm. and having my students always have to engage in some kind of action in order as part of the learning.
Amazing.
Right? Mm-hmm. That is my approach. It's always been my approach. So sometimes, I mean, one of the things that happens, you know, in our program is that, I mean, it's interesting because in the beginning, I would get very little respect from the other departments, right? Because it's historical studies.
Not surprising.
So there's women's studies, there is classics, there's history, there's religion, the four main ones. And for my other, you know, for my religion and classics and history, I mean, I had one colleague said to me, "Oh, I mean, what do you teach? Can you teach activism?" And I just looked at her, you know, and I thought, like, "Fuck you," in my head, you know, like, you're talking about activism as if it's not theory, mm-hmm. you know, and you're talking about activism as if it's something that is, you know, one does not theorize, and the fuck and the shit that you all teach up in here in history and in classic don't have no relevance to the real world. Mm-hmm. You understand what I'm trying to say? Mm-hmm. Right? So, you know, so I would get, you know, people would treat me as if I'm just there to teach activism, but I'm not as a real scholar.
Of course, yeah.
Right? Because, you know, because I am so, I emphasize activism work. And I also challenge the way in which they deal with students on campus. Mm-hmm. And I challenge, you know, the way that the environment treats students on campus. So they see this as activism work and they don't see this as academic work. You know, so, you know, I would hear certain things. That has actually dissipated, I think, because I think they recognize that I'm actually quite a scholar, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. You know, and the things that I would say and the way I would say, they couldn't possibly comprehend and put that together. So, you know what I mean? So I think that's shifting. But I remember in the beginning, I was treated as not a real scholar.
Yeah, I mean, it's the anti-intellectualism of... it's the anti-intellectualism of scholar activists that, you know, so it's funny because folks like us struggle in sometimes political movements that don't want to have the intellectual aspects. And then, you know, in the academy where you're also doing intellectual work that is very much about the material conditions of the world and have we changed them, the activist component of our praxis gets de-intellectualized as well. So it's this, you know, this challenge of being, and I think this is why I felt this podcast was really necessary to actually highlight the ways in which you need these kinds of pedagogies towards freedom making. You know, you can't disconnect them. So to the last question then, you know, you've done amazing work in demanding no policing and pride. And recently in the city of Toronto, there have been calls for defunding the police on a widespread level. And despite these calls, the city of Toronto recently voted to increase its police funding for reforms, which is, of course, not surprising, and we know are ineffective. So can you briefly just comment on this decision? And then I want to just sort of end with asking you, and what are you hopeful for in this moment, despite these kinds of decisions around, you know, defunding?
Well, I mean, what I would say quite bluntly is that this city, the mayor, and those who voted with him showed absolutely no courage. Mm. They showed no respect, no commitment, no care for Blacks, racialized and indigenous and marginalized, you know, and poor people in this country. They made that very clear and these people comprise many of their constituents. Mm. So they're saying to their constituents, we don't care that your lives are in peril. Mm. We don't care that people in your community are dying at the hands of the police. Mm. We are going to support more militarization. We are going to pump $50 million over 10 years into the police. We are going to continue to protect capital. We are going to continue to protect private property. We are going to continue, you know, to take further our oppression of racialized people in this context and their labor. Mm. Right? We don't care. Our priority is the protection of a certain class of people in this city, and they happen to be white, middle class, and corporate. Mm. That's our objective. So that's very clear. that that was the decision and the way in which they voted. I mean, the city voted for more power for itself from the province. I think that has to be noted, right? Mm-hmm. Right, which is a, you know, but it did not vote in the interests of those who were most marginalized. It ignored the fact that so many deaths have occurred within the period of the pandemic by police. They continue to foster a law and order agenda in this city. What I would say is that I think that it's important for us to, I mean, I think we knew that we would not get anything. I mean, I think that we probably thought we might get something, like a some sort of disarming, but, you know, to some extent, or maybe even a 10% decrease in budget. But the fact is that we cannot rely on the city, the state, or any level of government to protect us. Mm-hmm. We have to come up with our own solution of creating ways to create community safety. We are the ones with the imagination, not them. Exactly. They lack imagination, they lack foresight, right? And they lack commitment, and they lack courage. So we are the ones who have to come up with the vision. And we are all, and there's so many of us on the ground are visionaries.
Of course.
Right? So it's us, it's up to us to turn this around. And the way to do it is to continue to take over spaces in this city, to capture spaces. Mm-hmm. To take over empty buildings, make occupy spaces and places in this city, to continue to protest and to continue to demand change, and to keep that kind of pressure up while we also create alternative ways to protect our communities.
And so on that note, as you are a radical thinker and you have a radical imagination, what are you hopeful for, and especially in this time?
I'm hopeful for the people. I mean, you know, I think we have, I've seen hope. I've seen a lot of hope from people on the ground. That's where, I mean, a lot of our young folks today have taken to the street. Mm-hmm. And I'm hopeful that we can finesse and continue to foster that kind of energy and sustain that among our young people, and to continue, and also to create hubs where we can actually have conversations around how we strategize, how we think through these political questions, because it's not just about the doing, because a lot of the work that we do gets usurped by the state and turned on us. Mm-hmm. So we also have to have a political vision and a language and a theorization that our young people have to also engage in ways that is actually intersectional, that also is, you know, anti-racist, anti-capitalist, anti-colonial. We really have to stress that in our conversations and in our process as we actually do the work.
Well, Beverly, this conversation has been so amazing. Thank you for the historical context of really highlighting for us the struggle that dates, you know, decades and decades back. And for providing all sorts of political insight here today, your pedagogical insights, and for the powerful and important work you do in the classroom and beyond, and this lovely, lovely conversation. Thank you.
Thank you, Chanti. Thank you so much, and all the best to you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Liberation Pedagogy Podcast. If you'd like to learn more and engage with us, please check us out at www.liberationpedagogyproject.com and follow us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook.